Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, everyone, it's very exciting. Our guest is David Matalone, the writer, one of the writers for The Incredible Totally Killer, which is out now on Prime Video. Dave, welcome to the show. Congratulations on Totally Killer also, by the way. It is, in fact.
Thank you.
Totally Killer.
Thank you. I'm going to make a small drag. It's Matalone. Matalone would be my Italian cousin.
Matalone. David Matalone. I apologize. I thought it was so. Okay. I was confident. Right. It's always when I don't ask and I have the confidence.
And you did it with gusto, which I appreciate. You know, wrong and strong is always the Brooklyn way. But I will say you are in good company because my name has been slaughtered by more people than the killer did in Totally Killer. So,
put it on the poster.
Exactly.
I'm in the same boat because my last name is Menard, but it's spelled Mesnard. And so I am constantly slaughtering my last name too. It's a good way to tell if it's a telemarketer or someone that knows me.
Yeah, it's a robocaller. Mr. Matalone. Actually, I had a kid in my class in grade school named Eric Fuckler, and he had a hard time in life. And it was Fuchler.
Oh, but it was actually no.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm not allowed to curse, right? Or I forget that.
Curse away.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Sorry. Sometimes I wonder.
Growing up at that time period with that name, I'm surprised he didn't become.
I used to work with a colleague whose last name was Cox, spelled C-O-C-K-S.
Oh,
no!
Spelled C-O-C-K-S. Yeah. And the amount of times that his name would cause emails to not get sent because people think that, you know, the profanity filters out of emails that companies have. Yeah.
First name, Michael. Sorry. Anyway.
Oh, my God.
Are they a comedy thing or are they?
So, Totally Killer, what's that? So you are one of the writers, and also the story is by you and Sasha Pearl Raver. Can you tell us a little bit about how this project came to be and how you got involved?
Yeah, Sasha and I have been writing a few different things together, and We wanted to do something that was, you know, as they say in my business, familiar but fresh. We were big horror fans and then we were kind of like, what haven't you seen yet? Because I think we had seen Happy Death Day and we're like, oh, that's cool, you know, Groundhog Day and a horror movie. And we're like, what movie from our beloved childhood could we turn into a slasher fest? And then, you know, we both were big fans of Back to the Future, who isn't? And then we were just like, what if we kind of mashed that up with Scream? What would that be like? And then just kind of even just peeling back the sands of time and looking at the images of people, what they were doing in the 80s versus now. You know, I have a son and he basically gets on his bike and has to wear armor, you know, whereas like we were like standing on our seats, you know, and like going through traffic. And I mean, I remember we found a picture of a woman in a parking lot at a supermarket had left her child laying across the back behind the headrest asleep with the windows down while she went into the supermarket. Probably was a lit cigarette in the ashtray at the time too. And it just became such a ripe world to kind of delve into and mix, you know, and juxtapose those two worlds, our world now and the 80s. Which is kind of when so much horror really happened and really kind of exploded, right? So it was the perfect place to go. Literally.
As someone that I was born in 81, I, you know, survived through the 80s as a kid. I lived in Alaska, but it was all like freedom. So I'm just like wandering through the forest alone by myself. Should have been eaten by a bear, should have been killed many times by misadventure, and I somehow survived. And so, yes, I do know exactly what you mean about that time period. But what I did appreciate about Totally Killer is that it does not look at the 80s through rose-colored glasses. I loved the juxtaposition of someone from 2023 coming back into the 80s and being like, wow, everyone is saying horrible things. And it did remind me of that time where people would throw out expletives. I was remembering watching like Monster Squad, and within the first like 5 minutes of the kids meeting, they're calling someone the F slur. Like, it just, so looking back on that time without rose colored glasses is something that I appreciated. Was that sort of an intentional thing?
Yeah, it wasn't all rainbows and unicorns. I think it's really easy to look back and go, or bloody unicorns, and go, wasn't that a great time? Didn't we have more freedom? But you know, when you hold up any kind of lens of sensitivity and awareness and just being a human being, the sheer, you're like, you said it really well. I survived my childhood because, it was tough. It was hard. There was on just brutal bullying, brutal name calling. Yep. Some people, you know, you weathered it, you toughened up, you know, in my neighborhood, you had to. It's just kind of, I grew up, as I said, in Brooklyn, but some people didn't. And I knew kids who didn't and who were really hurt by it. And it was really important for us to kind of say, yeah, this was funny and fun, but it wasn't all great either. We've come a long way and for good reason. And I think the movie really successfully, you know, points those things out. It shows, here's some good stuff. And then here's some not such great stuff that went on.
Yeah, that's what I really liked, because I do think that we have, you know, particularly within the last, I don't know, decade or so, Stranger Things, the It movies and stuff, like the way that we look back on the 80s is the same way a lot of movies in the 80s were looking back with nostalgia on the 50s. And so whenever I see a movie that does not do that, I definitely take note of it, because as someone that was a closeted queer kid growing up in the 80s, was not the best time.
Not a good time, yeah. And you know, you watch movies, especially those beloved John Hughes movies, which are amazing, but they're cruel and they are judgmental and they are definitely geared towards certain people and very intolerant of other people. And, you know, you kind of have to – I think what you said is really great. It's great to look back and look at it as a time capsule and go, that's who we were, and maybe learn lessons from that, which is what we tried to do with Totally Killer, of, you know.
Yeah.
So what was the process of getting this to Amazon? Because, I mean, like, that's it's nuts. I mean, and you also, just look at your IMDb, it seems like you're relatively new in terms of, like, writing screenplays and, like, making films. And please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just going by IMDb.
That's fine.
Yeah, what was that like getting in front of Amazon?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first, I'll talk about the second part. The funny thing about Hollywood that they don't teach you at film school, I went to NYU. And then you come out there and you're like, I'm going to make movies, is that they don't teach you the business of being in the film business and the business of a career. And, you know, I was doing seminars for a while, like how to have a career as an artist, because it's a whole different animal. And so I know what a lot of people don't know is that there's an entire, I don't know, cadre of writers who sell things regularly, or what we call option stuff, which just means you give someone the right to try to get it made. And that's a whole other complex thing. We're a podcast, but and so you can make a very good living selling and optioning and not actually get a lot of stuff made. And I know some, you know, and then you'll hear about these writers who are overnight successes. And the same is true of actors. A lot of actors will kick around for a long time, and then the town gets to know them, and then they find that one thing that hits and goes through. So while the Totally Killer is probably the first big movie I've had made, it's not the first movie I've sold by a long shot. So
hell yeah. Cool. I was wondering. I was like, I think there's more to your career than what IMDb is telling me. So I was curious about that.
It is quite remarkable how you can kind of look back and go, oh wow, I sold all those movies, but this one got made. And it's the more you kind of listen to how movies get made and how they don't get made, it's kind of amazing anything does get made. So we were so thrilled when this happened.
I mean, not to talk about me, I just wrapped on my feature film debut as a director. And it's a miracle any movie ever gets made. Like, I don't understand how we do this and why we do this. But we do it and we love it. But it really is truly a miracle that any movie ever is made.
And even really big ones, the more you read like the behind the scenes, they're just one moment away from not happening. I was listening to something recently about Lord of the Rings. And basically, there was one meeting with Peter Jackson that he had, and this one meeting, if it goes the wrong way, it's done. The movie doesn't happen, and that entire franchise doesn't happen. It's one moment. And that's, like you said, like you can be on set, and your star gets sick, or your days get cut, or your blah, 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 and then your movie
or weather just happens, and you have to film outside, and you have to change your whole schedule.
Or that.
I was reading was it Kyle Buchanan? I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now, but he wrote a book detailing it was an oral history of the Mad Max Fury Road movie. And he was going into that film. And the fact that that film ever got made is a miracle in and of itself. And it detailed like the 20-30 year process that George Miller was doing, trying to get this movie off, and all of the like times fail and fall apart at the last minute, where it was like a meeting where you're ready to go and then something happens and it's like, well, we're not doing this. And so you put it to the side and you pray that it's so you'll get a chance to. It is amazing that movies get made now.
Yeah. I mean, and now they're making fewer than ever. I mean, it's kind of, there's a lot of great books on how movies get made, but there's one great one Peter Bogdanovich did where he, it's Who the Devil Made It. And it basically goes from the silent era all the way up through. And what's amazing about the silent era is they made like 300 movies. If you go to IMDb of a silent movie director, like Roald Walsh, he's got like
nuts.
500 movies. Cause like, he was like, all right, today we're going to, it's a wrestling picture. Tomorrow we're going to do a Western picture. And you know, and that, and then just sort of now it's like 10 and they're all based on books or comics, and it's really hard.
Established,
you know,
IP.
It's really hard. I just watched a movie today, which I love because it was an original sci-fi movie, and it wasn't based on a graphic
what
novel.
It?
Just the creator.
I still need to see that.
I haven't seen that one yet.
And I just wanted to see it in the theater to support original content.
Yeah.
So
that's why it's exciting with yours too, with your film Totally Killer, because as you know, in the horror world, I mean, IP is king right now.
Yeah.
It has been, but especially, I mean, this year we saw Scream, we saw the new Exorcist movie, Five Nights at Freddy's is coming out this week. I mean, IP is king. So it's really cool to see a slasher like Totally Killer. I know it's on Prime Video, but still, like, a slasher like this that is an original concept get so much attention.
I think that's one of the reasons we've had such positive reaction to it, because I think people are hungry for something new. And I think it's probably easier, more palatable, and safer to kind of take something you know works and just do it again. But I think audiences want something fresh. They want a new story. They don't want to just hear the same thing again and again. They want to be surprised,
right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's something Totally Killer delivers, and it's fun, it's funny, it's a good time. It's, you know, in these very difficult times, you can just sit back and enjoy yourself and go, that was nice, I like that. Gross. Yeah.
It's gory, it's fun, nice. Like fun teen slasher horror. It's entertaining.
Yeah.
And like, I've talked about this all over the place, like I love a good bleak movie, but I also love a good like fun slasher that is good to watch with a group of people, or like for Halloween. There is something I think really important about movies like that too. I think horror can be just as entertaining as it is serious.
Yeah, I think so. I mean my favorite movies have often been horror movies, and they've been incredible. They you know, of course the 70s, everyone was bleak, everyone like died of syphilis or something like that, or just like divorced and died of syphilis in the 70s, you know. With a lot of hair, a lot of facial hair.
And like, and the devil might show up every once in a while and take someone's baby or possess somebody.
Exactly,
He was like,
it was always the bleakest endings in the world. I remember like when I really got into 70s movies, I just walked around. I think I just wore black for months at that time because I just could be very, very
your mouth era.
Exactly. That was my God era. Exactly. Like, you know, it's all not going to work out. Someone call Robert Altman. And then the 80s came along and said, we can have horror, we can have fun, and things can end okay. And it can be – some people will be dead, but the people you like will be okay, and you'll go home and you'll have – you know, go out to Jerry's and have burgers or something like that. So I feel like I prefer upbeat endings, frankly, you know, to Lars von Trier movies. I think he's a wonderful director, don't get me wrong, but it's just like for my night
off. I almost bought Dancer in the Dark the other day.
That's like a slow slide down a razor blade, that movie. It's like,
I know. I'm like, I don't know if I want to even buy this movie. Like, I don't know if I want it in my home. The energy that radiates off this movie in general, like you said, starts bad and just gets worse. Terry, have you seen Dancer in the Dark?
No, I've not seen that one. I'm not as familiar with his filmography.
Most movies don't end that horribly for the character, and that's the start of the movie. Yeah, she just like goes from worse to worse. It's just terrible. I remember seeing that in the theater and then just like walking. I was living in Manhattan, and I was walking. I think I walked across the entire city just like, oh, what am, yeah, how will we ever
recover? You're like, what do I – yeah, I think after I watched it, I just sat in silence and was like –
yeah.
I don't know what you do after that. I just bought
flowers and gave them to people to cheer them up. To hope my gloom didn't bring them down.
Like, some happiness in the world, please. Exactly. Some kind of injection of smile. Good God.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, anyway. So you are a horror fan. Did you grow up a horror fan? Like, when did you get introduced to the horror genre?
I did. I mean, I was kind of a bit of a latchkey kid, and my parents were out a lot. They were like, and they liked to go out and have a, you know, for they're either working or doing stuff like that. And once I could take care of myself, you know, by the time I was like six, they just handed me the key. No, I'm kidding. A little older. But I would sneak.
I've heard everything on this podcast. We've heard everything in this podcast. Like, yeah, okay, six. Hey, you know, parents are parents. Well, the funny
thing, Terry was talking about going to school in Brooklyn. You know, when I was a kid, I had to walk 20 minutes to the subway. I'd ride the subway 45 minutes to Brooklyn Heights, get off, walk 15 minutes to a bad neighborhood, and that was where I went to middle school. And I took my wife on the subway one time, and I showed her, like, this is the road. She's like, I would never let our son do it. I said, well, I was, like, 10. She's like, I would not let him do it when he was 20.
You're, like, 10. That's not – you were a tiny child. You're, like – it's New York.
I was a big 10. I was a robust 10. Yeah.
Okay. Pardon me. Sorry. A robust 10-year-old.
I was a tiny child. I think someone mistook me for an Oompa Loompa once. But no, I was really small. But anyway, no offense to Oompa Loompas. And it's tough. So I don't even remember the question. I'm just totally on. Oh, horror. So horror movies. Yeah, I mean, so I watched a lot of horror and probably movies I shouldn't have watched because there was no one to tell me not to.
Oh, yeah.
I remember, like, getting the graphic novel, the Marvel graphic novel to Alien, and, like, there's, like, a spread where someone bursts. I see it. I'm like, well, I have to go see this in person, and I have to go. So I snuck because you couldn't get into rated R movies. So you had to, like, ask some guy walking by, like, hey, I'll buy you a beer if you get me into this rated R movie, and then he would get you in. And he'd buy you a ticket.
The good old days of sneaking into movies. No,
I didn't do that, but other kids I know did.
Of course.
I didn't buy people beer, but I definitely got people to sneak me into movies. I'll own the full fact. I was a little shit. I figured out all the ways to get into the horror movies in high school. No one was keeping me from seeing that shit. Yeah. My parents wouldn't take me. I was like, no, I'm going.
No, my mom still won't go see horror. She won't go see Totally Killer. I mean, you know, so she...
It's like my parents are like, we respect it, but we will not be viewing it.
My mom's like, I know it's good because you wrote it, so I know it's good. So I'm congratulations.
Have her press play and mute it in the background so at least you get to play on Amazon.
She can watch like 3 minutes of it. I loved horror. And I mean, sci-fi, horror, I feel like they're kind of, you know, in-laws to each other. They live next. So I was a big sci-fi, a big horror person. I mean, again, everything like Poltergeist I loved. And, of course, all the classics, The Shining, Jaws, Alien, you know, all the biggies. But then I loved Halloween. And my neighborhood, my house looked like the Amityville Horror house. So when I saw the Amityville Horror, I didn't sleep for like a week. Yeah. I don't know if you guys ever covered that movie, but that's
we cool. haven't. Oh, now I should mention it.
Damn it.
We haven't, have we?
Yeah. We haven't covered the Amityville Horror, which is wild. Yeah. That is actually kind of shocking that we haven't covered that one yet either.
And my house like had the chimney in the middle and then the A-frame kind of thing in the third floor. We had like the little rounded windows that you couldn't quite see in. And so you'd walk up the street and you could see my house. And I got to tell you, because of the movie we're going to talk about later and because of that, I would always kind of look up at that window and... You know, when you're a kid, your imagination, was there a face in the window? Was that somebody? So, and my neighborhood looked just like the Halloween neighborhood. Like, we had very similar trees and blocks. So, I was like, it was a very rich childhood full of terror.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine.
So, did you have siblings that you watched horror with, or was it just you?
No, well, I had an older brother who's like, he and I were just opposites. He's like a big sports nut. So, he would like go...
Okay.
He would watch the main TV because he was older, and I would like have to go to the basement, which was furnished but still the basement in the dark, and watch the crappy TV.
It makes sense. You got put into the cave to watch the horror movie.
Yeah, I had to go to the cave. And it was such crap that I had to use a pliers to change the channel on the. It was like one of the. It was an old like color TV from like the 60s.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. Yeah, with the dials.
Yeah.
My first TV was black and white, and I remember trying to play this Nintendo video game that had power-ups, and one was a positive power-up and one was a negative power-up, and you played it and I couldn't tell the colors of them because it was like red and blue. So it's like, maybe I'm going to get one that's going to be helpful, maybe I'm going to get one that's going to hurt me, and you just play that. With it. That's what you have.
Yeah. It's what you just work with what you got, man. Yeah,
exactly.
You work with what you got. That's how it was. That's why we're tougher. No, I mean,
exactly. So were you a scared kid growing up watching horror movies? Or
that's a really great question. I wasn't joking. I was a small kid, and I kind of filled out. You can't tell, but I'm enormous now. In college, and I was kind of small most of the time. So where I grew up, it was a bit. You know, where I grew up was nice, but you cross certain avenues. It's New York and certain streets, and it got rough quick. So I actually. When I went out for sports, the coach was like, "You're fast. You're really fast. How come?" I'm like, "Well, I have to run from people to survive. You know that, right? You live here too." And so I was a small, fast kid, but I was it was scary. I think it's really interesting because I think like my son now isn't scared at all, and just also because I've instilled confidence in him. I've been like, you know, don't have to be scared, but like. Even I feel like the trailers were scarier. You know, I could go on and on. Like there was like one for Magic with the puppet. You guys ever see the trailer for that?
I'm going to have to look it up once this is over. Cause I vaguely remember.
I think I have, but yeah, it's freaky. From what I remember.
It's freaky. It's like this little puppet. And he's like, "Hocus Pocus, you'll be dead." And I'd be sitting alone in the dark in my house. And I'm like, holy I'm just going to leave the room. And I remember kind of go into rooms and I would kind of turn on the light from outside the room. I'd reach around to turn on the switch and then, you know, there was no Alexa to turn on the lights. I had to do it manually. You know, I mean, I feel like now it's really hard to scare anyone. You just go, "Alexa, turn on all the lights. Turn on the fire blasters too, and let's kill everybody."
That is so funny you say that because like my family is always like, "Why are horror trailers so scary?" to me all the time. And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't like, I work in horror, but I don't make the trailers."
Right.
But that's so funny you say that because my family is very much not horror peoples, and they still get terrified by the trailer. So it is
maybe you just become inured to it after a while. Yeah, I mean now it's just like, I mean, especially really gory stuff, I find myself sort of more laughing at the absurdity of it than being scared by it. Like, it's just really over the top. I'm just like, that's
it's just like
amazing.
There's just no way. Yeah, exactly. You're like, that's just cool to watch that someone made
that's
that.
Just
like
cool.
Someone
how long is his vertebrae? That just keeps going, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh my god. Have you seen Saw 10 yet?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Okay. I don't know if you care about Saw 10. Terry, did you see Saw 10 yet? Saw X?
Yeah. No, I care. I just haven't had a chance.
There's one kill that's like incredible that involves someone's leg. And I was like, it's the wildest thing, but it's really cool to watch because you're like, this is dumb, but I love it. I love every second of it.
But the slasher, I feel, is like a subgenre, right, within horror. I feel like, you know, sometimes I just want to be scared. I just want a movie that's just scary. Actually, I just watched Barbarian recently, and I thought that had some great tension and scares to it. I mean, the door, and then there's another door, and you're like, there's another door. What's the hell's going on in this place? Yeah. So.
That movie's so good.
Yeah.
I do love that one.
So I like to be scared, you know, and then sometimes you just want to go on kind of the fiesta of blood and just, oh, wow, look at that. Yeah.
Would you say that it's harder to scare you now?
Me?
Yeah.
It's really hard. It's so funny because you get like jump scares every now and then that surprise you. I thought the last Halloween reboot, the first one of the most recent reboot they did.
Oh, the 2018, Yeah,
the first kind of, we're going to start again. I thought that had some really good jump scares and surprises, and I think it got me a few times in that one. I'd say it's much harder than it was, and trailers don't scare me at all. I'm like, oh, that looks scary. That'll be fun to watch. So, but my wife is a great barometer for me for something scary or not, because she's like jumping across, like climbing over things, grabbing my arm, and like, you know, So
I love watching movies with people that have a visceral reaction. Though that is my favorite. It is like my catnip.
Well, it's also very funny because I'm no longer allowed to when people are like, "So what's a good scary movie?" I'm like, I need more information from you because I am not a good barometer of what's scary. I know. I'm like, where do you land? Like, what scares you? Because I'm really bad at this with people who are not big horror people. Like, you got to tell me or I'm going to ruin your life. Like, I've done this before and I will not do it again. I don't want people to be mad.
I'll tell you a quick funny story. You can leave it in or not. But my wife and I went to one of those interactive haunted houses that Neil Patrick Harris puts on in L.A. I don't know. Where are you guys based in? What part?
I'm on the East Coast.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, they do this big interactive haunted, and they get actors and makeup, and they dress the professional set dressers, and they dress the whole house. And if you haven't been to one, you'll love it. And you go in, and they take you on a tour, and there's a whole story, and the actors, like, drop from the ceiling on wires, and they scare you, and they do this whole thing. And the finale, they take you to the basement, and you kind of work your head down. You end up in the basement in a cage, and there's, like, a summoning circle, and there's a guy doing a summoning. And they bring everyone out of the cage and they line them up and they go, one of you will be the sacrifice. And who do they pick? My wife, who's already so far gone in this scenario. Like she is really having trouble separating the fact that we're just in a spooky house thing. I keep going, honey, we weren't married yet, but I was still like, it's just a thing. And it's like, the music's playing. So she can't hear a word I'm saying. I'm like, it's just a thing. And they take her and they tie her, they chain her to this wall with her arms crossed over her head like this. And they start doing this whole ritual, and I swear to you, a demonic guy with animal legs and hooves and horns, probably about 7 feet in height because he's up on a stilts, all in makeup, bursts out of the floor.
Oh.
My wife, at the time, screams, lifts herself up, and mule kicks this guy in the nuts.
Oh, no.
Because he's just this demon has burst out of the floor for all intents and purposes. It is realistic looking in every living room. And she slams him. And so afterwards, we were with someone who knew the guy who ran the whole thing. He says, we call that the pee corner because people either pee themselves. And this guy apparently wears a giant cup because she's not the first person to just haul off. And they always take a woman and someone invariably kicks him in the nuts because they're anyway. My little story.
Wow.
I thought as horror people you'd appreciate that.
I definitely do appreciate that.
I'm sorry if it's off topic.
There's no off topic on this podcast.
You were already, and then you're like, and then the man appeared. I'm like, oh no, not the tall man. Like that's a recipe for disaster.
He literally looked like the Tim Curry in Legend. He was just enormous. And like he full on demon appearance. I thought it was quite entertaining.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
On that incredible note, Dave, we'll talk to you about your horror history, but what movie did you bring with you today as your Scarred for Life pick?
When a Stranger Calls, the Carole Kane version.
The Carole Kane version. So listeners, you remember on Little Cuts, we talked about this. Our mini episode talked a little bit about this. So we're excited to have a whole main episode about When a Stranger Calls. And for those unfamiliar, a psychopathic killer terrorizes a babysitter, then returns 7 years later to menace her again.
Ugh. Classic. All right. So take us back. How did you see this movie? How old were you? Why is this your Scarred for Life pick? I want to hear your horror story.
So I'm probably about 8 or 9. I'm home at our house in Brooklyn. We live in a 3-story house and the house had these big windows that looked out. First of all, we had a driveway on one side. We had an alley on the other. And then you'd look out across the street and it just looked out on the big empty street with the amber street lamps, you know, just glowing. And those lamps in those days, I don't know if they deliberately did it, but they never felt very bright. Now I feel like everything's, you know, white, hot, ultraviolet beams spotlighting you. But those days, you could kind of luckily get a little bit of light directly in it. And I remember I was home alone. My parents had gone out. My brother was probably out at a friend's house. And I was like, I'm going to watch TV we had like a TV room. So I was going up to the TV room and watch it. And I had my little dinner stuff. And I, as they always said, I reached around the corner to the dark room and I would flick on the light by reaching around the corner and make sure there's no one in there. Mm. I turn on the TV and I turn on this show. And at the time you just watched what was on. You didn't get to choose. Yep. And I think the other stuff just wasn't that good. So like, I'm going to watch this. This seems good. It's about a babysitter. What could go wrong? And vaguely, I remember being at camp or somewhere and someone telling a similar story. And the creepiest thing about this story is the moment when the babysitter is calling the police and she keeps getting the creepy calls. And then the cops say, he's in the house. Get out of the house. We had a phone in that room. And it was one of those old, you know, dial phones that had a really yep. loud ring that sounds like it's like a movie sound effect ring. And I was watching that movie alone in that room in the dark, and the phone rang as I'm watching it. And I literally got up, ran downstairs to the kitchen, grabbed like a one of those things that you use to stab like meat when it's on the barbecue, like a little prong thing.
Oh yeah, like the poker thing, yes. Poker whatever.
I don't know. Like the closest thing I could think that felt like a weapon to me that I wouldn't kill myself with. And then I ran up to my room, but I didn't want to slam the door, so I kept the door open. And I turned the light on. I just sat in my room with the light on, just waiting there till someone finally came. I think it was my brother who came home first. I was like, "Mark," and he's like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Oh, okay, yeah." He's, "You okay?" "Yeah, I'm great. I'm fine." Just been sitting here in my room for an hour and a half waiting for you to come home. So that was my terror. And the funny thing is, like, if you go back and watch it, it's not terribly terrifying now. But that conceit, and when you're young, the idea that, you know, someone could be calling. And also the other thing was, in our house, the stairs wound, like, we had three floors, as I said. So you come up around the stairs, there was a landing, and then you go second landing, you come to the second floor, and then it wound up again. And the third floor was where my parents slept, but if the lights were out, it was just dark. You just looked up, and it was just dark up there, and the door would be open, and there was just a whole floor of dark where I'm sure all the monsters live.
Every demon lives there. Every ghost, every monster, they live there in that dark room.
So I used to, like, kind of walk by it. I would, like, kind of put my hand by my side of my face to avoid it.
Yep.
I did a lot of that.
Sounds like me as a kid.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Wow. So did you not watch the rest of the movie after that moment?
No, I never saw it. Actually, it wasn't until later in life that I watched the rest of the movie. I think I got, like, just through that first part. And I was like, oh, there's a whole murder thing here. Interesting. And then I think when I was older, you know, in high school, I watched it again. But at that time, that was it. You know, once it got to about the point where he goes to the asylum, right? I think he goes to an asylum, and then Turning shows up and he breaks out. And I was kind of watching that. And then the phone rang and I was like, nope.
Okay.
Nope,
so I'm done. Basically saw the actual horror part. And then you saw the police procedural part that is also the most depressing part of the entire movie, which is about how people who are mentally ill are treated like shit and thrown out onto the streets and then commit the crimes again because they don't have anywhere else to turn.
Exactly.
I love that this movie has a 2006 remake that is just the scary part and not like the entire back half that's police procedural and also like sad social drama.
Right. The ending has a pretty good scare. The ending has the bedroom scare. Yeah.
It does. Yes. That's a good point. That's a good point. The ending does have a very good scare.
A movie from that time, it's hard to do those scares now because, like, they've been done. So, like, you're like, oh, he's there or that. So everyone guesses it. So, you know, like, but that time it was pretty good.
It is really interesting you mentioning, like, the lack of color ID and how this movie is so easy to be scary in the 80s. And, well, the census was 79. Because we didn't have caller ID, and it was, and I know we've seen plenty of ways in horror where you get around that, but still, there's something about that threat of like answering a landline and not knowing who it is and not being able to tell who it is. I know Star 6-7, was that the one that you would call? Was it Star 6-7?
Star 669.
Okay, Star 6-7, which one was Star 6-7? Was that blocking your number? When you called somebody?
I don't remember. But I do know Star 69.
I prank called enough people in high school that I should remember. but it is something so scary about that, like not being able to know who it is and just hearing that creepy voice. Have you checked on the children on the other end? Especially as a girl who babysat a lot as a child, this move. The 2006 one, actually, because that's the one I grew up with. That one ruined babysitting for me, even though that movie is not good for the era in which I grew up and was watching that era of horror. Ruined babysitting for me. This movie is a better movie.
It is in some ways. Although they smartly, I mean, that was the best part of the movie was, like, get out of the house. They're in the house. You know, that whole thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things where when people haven't seen this movie and I'm like, you got to watch this movie, because a lot of times people think that it is like the 2006 version where it is the entire movie Babysitter Alone in the House. And I do think it's very interesting that, that the first act is basically just this really intense, scary moment. And then it's like, oh, wait, there's another hour of this film. And you're like, what is going to happen now? And I do think every time I rewatch this, I do think the middle section drags a whole lot. I also think that it is kind of, it's a shame that we switched to this cop that's introduced at the very end of the first act, as opposed to following Carol Kane's character, because I think Carol Kane, she lights up the screen. I think she does puts on a phenomenal performance in this movie. And yeah. It makes me sad every time we get to the second act and I'm like, I want to know about Carol Kane. I'm happy we get back to her as an adult. And it's like an inverse of the original one where she's now the parent and has two kids. And like, I like that inverse, but boy, I do wish that we had kept with her through that middle section.
Yeah, it is odd. It becomes a sort of odd procedural, sort of like Beretta column, I guess, sort of the shows at that time. Like, let's do a cop drama now. But it's really interesting because what I found fascinating, because I was rewatching it a little bit prior to our discussion, is how long she stays on the phone with the guy when he first calls. Yeah. She's like, well, tell me more about how crazy you are. And you're like, why would you actually? And I just find it also just incredible to see how socially we've changed and how the way we deal with each other has changed. And, you know, you see that so much, especially when you look at these old movies and relationships, especially in between men and women and the way we relate to our children.
I love at the beginning where it's like, I forgot the days of when they're like, oh yeah, we wrote the restaurant number by the fridge, bye. And there isn't like any, like the kids are asleep, they're sick, who cares, bye. We're going to go maybe see a movie. We'll be back by like midnight. See you later. Like so basic. Like, and
yeah.
When I first started babysitting, it was in the early 2000s, like sort of like that, not as much, but as I got older and also been watching my cousins, like much more involved, like instructions of watching kids. So that was like really interesting. Just the idea of the babysitter and the role of what the babysitter was now versus then is really, really cool. Is really interesting to watch in this movie. I was thinking about that too.
You really were just kind of, I guess you just didn't think horrible things happened, or you just were just just assumed it was going to be okay. A
weird naivete, it feels like. You know what I mean? Like, you know, not even naivete, but just like, you know, people aren't going to fuck around. Like, people aren't that bad. But then movies like this are like, just kidding, people are that bad. Actually. Like, surprise. Like, people can be. And it's like, and what's interesting about this movie too, though, is like, they try to humanize him in a way that.
Yeah.
I think is really smart for the 70s. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, we don't want to humanize the killer, but I don't think they ever try to, they make you feel sympathy for him, but he's still a creep. And I'm like, damn, that was actually relatively well handled in 1979 of like trying to look at, again, the cycles of violence and perpetuating them because the system didn't take care of you. Like, that's incredibly smart in general, but for the 70s, especially that genre.
I thought that was in the zeitgeist of the 70s, right? It was a socially conscientious time. People were about understanding, you know, the sanitariums of old were being replaced with a more compassionate view of things. And it was about the system letting people down. It was less about, you know, it was coming out of like, ask not what your country can do for you. That mentality.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
And so it was, and that's why I think as a time capsule, it's interesting. And it's still scary, like you said, but I think you're right, the humanizing of it. Although, like, if I think back to Psycho, isn't like the end of Psycho like an hour and a half of the psychologist explaining why?
When we covered Psycho, we were laughing. We were like, just in case no one understood what was happening here, here's an exact layout of the character psychology and why he did that. And it's like,
yes.
But again, like, there's this really interesting thing of giving us access to the killer without making him necessarily the good guy. But you still empathize because, again, like you said, we're seeing how the system's at play here and how society, which can be incredibly cruel, is kind of creating these monsters. Like, and that's terrifying. And I think that's a terrifying reality. But I also think it is our reality. And this movie really smartly does that. I mean, obviously it's not perfect, but I think, again, it's a really smart look at like, well, what happens when these guys get out and you don't do anything to, like, support them when they're out? Like, what happens? And if they're violent again, like, are they to blame? And I do think that's a really interesting conversation to have. We don't ever have that with slasher villains. Because, again, like, we get, like, Michael Myers and Freddy. But here, it's a really interesting kind of discussion about all of that.
Yeah, I think you bring up an amazing point, honestly, because I think prior to, and just as current to me now, because you're, you know, what you're saying, prior to Jason and Michael Myers, there is no super inhuman killing machine who just is killing because they're psychotically, that's all they can do. That's all that's left for them. And I think of a movie, I don't know if you covered Dress to Kill with Michael Caine and Angie Dickinson.
We did cover that.
Yes.
Oh.
Did we cover that?
I won't go too far into it, but like, that was another.
Sorry, I should remember if it was a guest or not, but don't worry about it, Terry. I couldn't remember if we covered it on a mini episode or a full episode, but we did talk a lot about that movie. I'm curious. Sorry, David.
We did with Duncan Birmingham.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine. I don't know. I'm sorry. I just see similarities in that there's a psychology of a killer. Right, it's not just this inhuman force of death and slashing coming to get you. It doesn't. It speaks. It has. It can be reasoned with. It can be understood. You know, versus just Jason's just.
Right. What I do love about the reveal though is so for the first 22, 23 minutes, you know, we just hear that voice and that the way he says it when he's like he calls her and he's like, "Have you checked the children?" It's just like. It's so quiet and it's so menacing, but then when you find out that the kids are dead and we see the cops and they're talking about how, you know, the coroner says that, you know, the kids weren't killed by knives or weapons, that they were just torn apart by hands. And so we get that image in our head of what kind of maniac is able to be that strong to just rip someone apart. And then when we finally see him played wonderfully by Tony Beckley, and he comes across as kind of sickly and he's small and he's not Jason. And you have a mind, particularly if you've seen this post, like a bunch of the 80s slashers where it's like, you know, Jason's unstoppable. Michael becomes, you know, unstoppable. You have Freddy Krueger in your dreams. But like once you've, because I didn't see this originally when it first came out, but once you have like this lexicon of what a slasher is, and then you finally see Tony Beckley's character, and he is scrawny, he's just an average person. And when you take that and you take the idea that he used his hands to rip apart these two kids, it's it makes it much more terrifying.
Yeah, and you kind of questioned it. Could he actually have done? How does one rip someone apart physically? I mean, that just seems, you know,
excessive.
excessive and impossible. But yeah, I think that's interesting because it does go against type and it does defy your expectation. I mean, that's smart on their part in terms of, you know, casting. Yeah, he has almost a Rorschach vibe, right?
He does have. But like even Norman Bates, I know Norman Bates was a more handsome, like he's very handsome and disarming. But again, like he's the skinny kind of like gangly nerdy looking guy.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say was this, I don't know why I'm just connecting it, but like Black Christmas and When a Stranger Calls are like great double feature because this is like, this guy reminds me, Kurt, the character reminds me of what Billy from Black Christmas would do or be. You know what I mean? Like I have a feeling Billy from Black Christmas could tear a child apart limb from limb. Because we never actually see what he does to that one girl, or what he might have done to that one girl at the beginning. Remember, they're like, there's a little girl they find dead outside, and you never like really hear what happened to her. It just like, to me in my head, I'm like, it's an interesting, like, is this what Billy, like what that character could have been like? It's a really interesting in just thinking about the comparison between the two of them. Have you seen the original Black Christmas?
Have you seen Black Christmas?
No, I don't know it.
Oh, it is really good. I highly recommend that one.
Okay. And best slasher. My favorite slasher.
I put on the list.
Okay. And it also has a classic case of the killers inside the house.
Oh, really?
There is a point where the cops call and he's like, he's inside the house. Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, it just works.
It does.
I mean, it's fucking terrifying. Like, telling me, like, that will scare me even now. Like, if the idea of someone calling from the house, like, I'm always terrified. I always check every room if I'm alone at night in, like, a new house. This, like, the concept of someone, like, I don't think this was the first movie to like popularize that by any means, obviously, but like that concept of like there's someone in the house and they're calling you is like top five biggest fear.
Well,
hate it.
Yeah, I mean,
thank you.
Caller ID like destroyed the crank call, right? You can't be like, "Hey, it's your uncle." Like, no, it's not. It's you. I see your phone number. No, it's your uncle. No.
No, you know, that's right. Really star 6-7 was how you could block your phone number, so you could still prank call on your cell phone. Because when I got a cell phone, you couldn't prank call anymore, but you still use the landline that had the caller ID. So I use the *67, so we can still prank call people in high school.
It's so funny because when writing Totally Killer is like. Think about all the things you can't do. Like, there's no cell phone. There's no house camera. You can't just use your Wyze cam. You know, there's no texting. You can't instantaneously contact
Google.
Anyone.
You can't Google anything. Like, you can't look things up this quickly.
My mom was like, you know, a long distance call was expensive. You stood in the hall phone and your mother timed you while you talked to another place. Like, it's $3 a minute or whatever it was, you know. And it's just such a different world, you know. It's just so... So it's interesting to see, like, and it's so funny because almost every good horror movie you see, my cell phone's dead, like, because you got to get rid of that thing, right?
Got to get rid of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No reception.
Yeah, I was watching this movie again last night, I was thinking about how ominous they portray the phone in this movie. And every time it rings, like I did find a trivia point where every time it rang, they would kind of increase the volume. So it was quiet and then it was becoming more menacing. 22 minutes going on. And I was watching this and I was thinking, man, I remember this phone and I vividly have this memory of being, I think I was like 14 or 15 and I was home alone and I answered the phone and I thought it was some guy that lived up the street, some older guy that was friends of the family. And I was talking with him and he's like, I'm not him. But the conversation started taking a more of a menacing turn. And I just remember like hanging up finally, just freaking up and hanging up the phone and just being like absolutely terrified and no way of finding out who that person was. And to this day, it's a mystery. I don't know who was calling. The conversation was turning kind of sexual. Like it was unnerving to me.
That's
as
dark.
A 14 or 15 year old. Yes. And so I was thinking about how dangerous the phone is and how, you know, you would just pick up the phone back then. Now, if someone's calling me, I'm like, I don't want to talk to you. But back then it was like your phone rings in the house and you pick it up and you answer it and you have a conversation with whoever it is. You don't know who it's going to be. And you just talk with them. And it's interesting how that dynamic has changed over the years. But yeah, I will never forget that night and just the feeling of dread that was in me. And then, of course, I don't know, a few years later, I finally sit down and I watch When a Stranger Calls. And it kind of brought me back to that moment of not knowing who's on the other phone and not knowing where they are, thinking that they are someone up the street and not knowing. Horrifying.
There's something jarring and violent about that ringtone. It's not like, you know... It's not like a Taylor Swift song sampled, you know. It's like dance on the bed, you know. It's like
you're like, oh my, shaking just, your brain in your head, like
it's just like it's in your heart, going shaking your heart, going hey, I'm gonna get you. And it was so like it's really just that, and then the cut, even like the resonant ring afterwards when it stops, is it sort of like that.
Yes.
Slight ping in the air and kind of fades
away.
It just sort of lingers
a little bit. Yeah. And then it goes again and it goes again.
Yeah. And it gets you every time and it has this great, I mean, I remember there was, especially in that era, there were a lot of movies that used the phone in that way to make you kind of jump and give you a jolt because it had that really horrible sound to it.
And like, speaking of the phone, I love the house that they use and how they film her in the house to build the tension in this movie. Because again, like we really only... She never goes upstairs. We just see her in like a couple rooms and it feels so claustrophobic, even though it looks like the house is big and pretty, like you get that vibe, but she's so contained in these couple of places in the house. And
they sort of surround her with shadow, right?
Yeah. It's just incredible in how they use light to make the whole house feel so unsafe and so claustrophobic. And again, it's that horror's favorite thing of making the house feel unsafe and the domestic space feel unsafe, but they really hit it from the beginning, especially as like she comes into this house, but it's not her house. It is a stranger's house. And she doesn't really know the kids. She hasn't met the kids at all because they were asleep already. And so she's just trapped in a, and they make it her feel trapped in a really fascinating way that I love in terms of how they build it up. And I think they go back to that a little bit at the end. But again, it's like that weird middle part that kind of completely disrupts what they're doing stylistically with the horror aspect.
Yeah, it's like a missed opportunity. Yeah, it's funny. It's so funny because being in the business of coming up with scary ideas, there's something genius about just this basic premise of, how do I make the place where you feel safest feel frightening and unsafe?
Yeah.
Like your sanctuary. How do I violate that? How do I come in there and make that feel like an unsafe place? And I think it touches – I think that's one of the reasons that it works universally. And even after all this time, like Terry was saying, like, you know, it just goes right to the heart of like, oh, my God, it's in my home. My home – the one place where I'm supposed to be protected.
Yeah.
You know.
The other thing I noticed last night as I was watching is I got to give a shout out to Donald Peterman, the cinematographer of this, who would go on to shoot Men in Black, Point Blank, Flashdance, whole bunch, Adam's Family Values. Like, he would go on to have a really big, extensive career. But what I realized last night as I was taking notes was the way that the camera would do still frames. Like, a lot of the reaction stuff would be, it would focus on the clock. It would focus on the melting ice cream thing that she had, that she left because she was terrified. It was sitting and melting on the counter. But the still frame shots of a lot of, like, it almost felt like crime scene photography. Like, this camera is just capturing this crime as it's happening. And it, like, it, as I was realizing this, I was like, man, there's some really subtle work here that, whether intentional or not, just really drives home the fear and creates this very unsafe feeling in this home. And a lot of it is just still frames. Like, it's still frames of objects and the scene. And I really admired that on this watch. I think the movie is better when it focuses on the horror aspect. I think the director, and I think the script is much better when it is dealing with the more personal horror stuff as opposed to the police procedural that happens. But when it works, it is so effective.
Yeah.
Hard. Yeah. Agree.
I am curious. Have either of you seen When a Stranger Calls Back, the sequel?
No.
Now
you mentioned it, I feel like I had heard of it, but I don't remember it.
Yeah. So it came out in 1993, I want to say, and it is sort of it's like it feels like a remake as well as a sequel to this, where we have like Carol Kane comes back, Charles Durning comes back, but it follows a very similar pattern to this movie where we're following this babysitter who is dealing with a man that is knocking on her door asking to come in because he says that his car is broken down, and she says, I will call the auto place, and she goes to the phone and the phone line is cut, and she has no phone line. She doesn't want to tell him that there is no phone because she's worried about him, so she lies and says that, you know, they're on their way. And as she's moving around the house, she realizes that things have moved in the house, and so she's realizing that there's someone inside the house with her. And so that's the opening for that. And then once she survives, like this movie, she's going to college and she's traumatized, and we're following her, and she gets introduced to Carol Kane's character, who starts to help her, and it like ties everything together. But I honestly think that movie is actually much better than this one. Wow. It's one of the rare sequels that I think surpasses the original one.
Okay, that's cool. I'll check it. I don't think I even knew about it. There's elements of this to probably what led to a lot of the home invasion movies that became like a subgenre and became so popular. Yeah. Like, even like you think about The Strangers, the whole idea of like you walk in a room and I put my phone there and now it's there. And just that alone is just like, okay, I know I put it there. So
yeah.
And all that, just that one simple shot, all that informs for the character, and you look around the house and now, you know, where, but all those movies kind of like explode in the 90s. All that home invasion stuff became a big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite subgenre, or one of my favorite.
Yeah, mine too. But it's wild to me also that the director, Fred Walton would go on to do a movie that we've also covered on the podcast, April Fool's Day. Same director as April Fool's Day that we've covered on the podcast.
That's right. He did do the April Fool's Day. I love that movie.
That movie's great.
That's hilarious.
Is there anything else you want to hit before we wrap up and give this a rating out of 5?
Just that you know, you guys can also check out, I did do an action horror zombie thriller on Crackle called The Clearing. It's now on Crackle. It was an indie movie I directed, which was an adventure of itself. We were talking about getting movies made, and that's why I was curious how your experience was, because, you know, once you get out there and you're on set and you're like, all right, I have a kid, practical effects, 50 extras, and 10 stunt people, and I have a half a day to shoot the entire scene. Let's go.
I did not have to worry about that.
But the movie came out great. It stars Liam McIntyre from Spartacus. He was Spartacus. He's an awesome actor, and it's like a high-octane, action-packed survival horror thriller. So check it out.
Terry, was there anything you wanted to hit about When a Stranger Calls before we give our rating?
I think the one last thing is, when we were talking earlier about the kind of humanity of show, a little bit of like giving us a little bit more about the killer and kind of humanizing him a bit. There's this one very striking moment where he is at the homeless shelter and he is naked and he is staring at himself in the mirror, and he is like having images back. And it made me wonder if he doesn't remember. Because, like, they go through all the things that they've done to him. Like, he was electroshocked 38 times. He's been on all these different pills. And it made me wonder if he was, like, when he got out of the asylum, that, like, he forgot everything that he had done. And it was this moment of staring at himself in the mirror and then realizing all the stuff that he did and kind of going back to his roots. Because it's, like, all of a sudden, that is when he goes after Jill again, and that is when we move into the finale. But it is this really heartbreaking moment of him just staring at himself in the mirror and then curling into a ball on the floor of, like, sadness. And it really struck me this time on this watch.
Yeah, it's interesting because we are essentially chemical, right? We're made up of a fine balance of chemicals, and when one of those things goes out of whack, you know, someone like that, you – it's horrible what he does, but is he in control of it? Is he in control of him, of himself? And what does a compassionate society do with a person like that? I think it's easy just to say, you know, the obvious answer. But if we are a compassionate society, is it, you know, is it his fault? I mean, clearly, it's horrible what he's done. But if you are not in your right mind because of whatever trauma has been inflicted on you, you know, I think it certainly opens up more complex questions and things that, you know,
yeah. Well, it's like the Clockwork Orange effect almost, of like Alex DeLarge getting programmed to no longer be violent, but then like what happens when the world is violent back at you and like you can't defend yourself anymore, and like what does that look like, and how, and this watch was definitely, I also think my mom had the same job she has now when I watched the movie for the first time, but my mom works for, she essentially runs a restaurant that employs unhoused or previously unhoused people who also have addiction issues. So it's like a lot of that kind of idea of like mutual aid, of like employing people who might have harder times getting employed, whatever. And like, I hear a lot of stories about how my mom has to confront how fucked all these systems are and how like little people care about people who are unhoused and mentally unwell. And it was really bad during the pandemic. And so watching this after hearing all of her stories after the pandemic is just like, Jesus, like things have not really, like, yeah, we can get to the nitty gritty that things have gotten like better, but things are by and large very similar.
I actually have a question for you guys, just your opinion. Do you think, because like modern horror movies, it's very clear who the bad guy is, or bad bird, you know, bad monster, creature, stalker, and there's no bones about it. That person needs to be stopped by any means necessary. But a movie like this, which kind of makes more ambiguous, right? You're given a look into that. I mean, how does it make you feel as a horror fan? Do you like something like this, or does it make you just give me a clean, clear enemy that I can chop up and shoot and run, you know? Or does it make it more less palatable?
I am here for give me the monster, give me the Freddy Kruegers, give me the Jasons that, you know, are bad. There's nothing, we don't need to humanize them. They're just monsters, killing machines, whatever, what have you. But my favorite are the stuff that makes you think and makes you sit afterward going, who is the, you know, who's the villain, or the more gray, morally gray areas. That's my kind of area that I love to sit in, is that more morally complex. I do think that there is a problem right now where there is either media literacy issues, or there are people that need to have characters be shining bright or dark, deeply dark, and just have them hit each other. But I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of us versus them in movies today. And I do love seeing a movie that kind of wades. Well, let's examine that. Let's kind of live in that gray space in between those two. And so for me, I would much rather have a movie like this in that regard.
Yeah.
I agree. I love a bleak ending. I am all about movies that are like incredibly morally gray and confusing and make you think like, that person actually kind of sucks and they were the lead character. Like, what does that mean in terms of like what we just saw? And I love that. I love being able to see from the perspective of complicated, like maybe not even good characters, but and I like learning about the complexities of that. I think there are so many ways to do that without it being like, look, feel bad for the person. Like, you can do these kinds of movies and still be able to empathize, but also still see they're bad. And I think there are a lot of great examples of this. I think this movie is definitely a good, like, early example. And I think that trend is continuing. And again, like Terry said, I do love a good, like, bad guy movie. Like, those are very entertaining. But if I'm looking for something to, like, really get into my head, it's the one where it's, like, very, much more ambiguous about who is bad, who is good. And maybe there isn't really one good or one bad. And we're all just kind of fucked up. Yeah.
It's interesting because it used to be these movies, you could pitch movies like, you know, the Harold and Maudes of the world. The morally ambiguous characters were more palatable and more what you saw in, I mean, Harold and Maudes is not a horror movie, obviously, but like, characters of that ilk, you know, the marathon man, very flawed taxi driver, you know, characters, and they're harder and harder in the marketplace to sell because buyers don't want that, because that's not what the sort of wide audience seems to be, at least for them. So, like, for me as a creator, it's hard for me to create characters like this because I won't find a place to get it made.
Well, and that's something that Terry and I have talked a lot about in multiple places, both online, offline, wherever, about how right now we're kind of going through a puritanical phase of cinema in a way that's kind of terrifying. There needs to, like, there's just everything is a very general statement. A lot of the bigger movies out there, not including Killers of the Flower Moon, I know that just came out. But, like, a lot of movies are so sanitized and very much, like, good versus evil, there is a clear winner. And I don't see that in horror and, like, indie horror as much, but I'm also watching a lot of indie horror. So, like, a person who's just watching horror movies in the theater are seeing more of that kind of puritanical. I mean, like, The Exorcist, we made another fucking Exorcist movie. Religious horror has always been big, but there's a big resurgence right now too, where it feels like God is saving us. Like, yay, we're excited that Jesus is coming to save us all, because, like, who else can save us from what's going on? And there's also a lot of talk about, like, sex in movies, which is so frustrating. Like, this continuous dialogue of, like, wanting to sanitize sex and queer sex and... It's just, like, a very weird time in film right now, and it's kind of disconcerting in terms of kind of, like, the weird conservatism and, like, puritanical nature of what seems to be more popular or what people think is selling. Because, again, in indie horror, like, When Evil Lurks that's coming out on Shudder, like, is fucked. Like, it's so bleak. But again, like, that's – and that had a limited theatrical run, which is awesome. But again, like, that's indie. So there's a lot of really cool stuff happening in indie, but in mainstream, like, everything and blockbusters, like, it's definitely a very puritanical time. And I don't love that at all.
Yeah.
Right.
That's how
I mean, it just ties back to what we were saying earlier about how difficult it is to get things done and, and actually made. And because, you know, what?
Well, and it's...
And probably places like Shudder are willing to take more of a chance on those indie movies because there's less overall risk. So they're kind of go, well, we can risk on 10. In one hits, we pay for our other 9. Which is great, yeah, because that's kind of what you cinema should be, right? It should be trying new things, exploring.
It is interesting about like how, and like, it's always, to me, when I like working on like the film side, it's like, who exactly is determining what's working? Like, is it us? Is the viewer? Is it like the people who are making the movies? Because obviously sales agents and people who are buying these things are saying, well, this is what the taste is. But then like, it's like a chicken or the egg situation that I get too much into my own head about. And I know we're getting into now nitty gritty of filmmaking, but it is like this weird chicken and egg thing of like, who exactly is deciding like what is popular right now? Like,
well, I can tell you in Hollywood, but I can also say that the market, since I started, the reasons movies are chosen and the way they make money has changed significantly over the last couple of decades because the advent of streaming, the collapse of the DVD market.
Okay.
This is not news. I'm not saying anything anyone hasn't told you, but because of that, there's a very specific group of people who are deciding, unless you're able to distribute, you know, via some streamer independently. But that is an issue. I mean, I think you've touched on a real thing because used to be, if I made a movie and I made it for $20 million and it didn't do well in the box office, I could just make it on international sales for streamers. I mean, sorry, right, for DVDs
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But now I can't do that. So now how do I tell my investor I'm going to risk $20 million of their dollars without that built in market? I can always say, look, we'll always make it. And I think that just starts changing what's getting chosen.
I hadn't thought about the collapse of the DVD market. So that's actually,
it's a huge, huge factor in the shape makes of what's
so much being made. Fucking sense. Huh.
Especially with like Best Buy just announcing that they're not going to be carrying DVDs in store anymore. And
there you go. Yeah. I mean, that was like one of the reasons that was one of the deaths of the mid-budget movie, you know, why rom-coms started going away, why a lot of these sort of genres that you're seeing that streamers will make because they're palatable because they're in that 10, 20, 30 range, but are really hard to get an indie investor to say, hey, look, put in $30 million. I hope you'll get it back. That's where you're seeing a lot more independent horror. Like, give me $1 million and there's less of a risk. You know,
fuck, overall, I made mine for $50,000.
It's still $1 million of someone's dollars. Yeah, there you go. But it's still $1 million of somebody's money, but you know, it's not nothing. But I'm just saying that's why the shape of the market has changed, and the filmmakers have had to adjust. Not just the directors, but the producers, you know. I mean, you could have a whole podcast just on how that market, since I've joined, has shifted and changed.
That's so fascinating.
And again, if you want to have a career as a creator in it, you can go, well, I'm going to do what I want. Or you can follow the market and try to get things made.
Right.
It's tricky, tricky business. Shit. Art meets commerce. It's not show friends, it's show business.
Man, okay, I'm not going to keep talking about this. I could talk about it forever. Right. And no, don't apologize because I got excited talking about it because whatever. But do we want to wrap this up and give this our rating out of 5?
Yeah,
that sounds good.
All right, Terry, you're up first. How many have you checked the children's out of 5 do you give When a Stranger Calls from 1979?
You know, it's tricky because I do think every time I watch this movie, I love the opening 22 minutes. Just it's still every time I watch this, it still instills dread in me. Like I am, even though I know how it's going to turn out. I know that the man is upstairs. I know that he is calling from inside the house. I know all of this. And yet it is still, it brings me back to a childhood fear of being afraid of who's going to be on the other end of that phone, or of being home alone, or being a babysitter, because I was also a babysitter in my early teens, and going into a house that maybe not familiar, maybe the kids aren't familiar to you, and just navigating that space. It does such a fantastic job of bringing me back to that every single time I watch it. I think the middle section still drags, although I think there's some very interesting thematic things that are being attached with it. It makes me sad when all of a sudden we're not following Carol Kane, who I think is just a phenomenal actress. And then we don't get to see her until the finale. And I'm just like, what happened to her in all those years? I want to know about her life. So it's hard, but I do think that this movie, like Scream references it with the opening 10, 12 minutes of Drew Barrymore. I think that it has left a mark in cinema history. I think that it is, when it's doing the horror, it's really effective. So I have to give it 4. Have you checked the children? Out of 5 for me. What about you, Mary Beth?
So I was looking at my Letterboxd and seeing what I rated this when I actually gave things stars, and I've stopped giving things star ratings because I can't deal with people's bullshit on that app sometimes. But I gave it 3.5, and I am going to bump that to 4, similar to you, Terry. I think talking about it here has really helped me. I already really appreciated it, but like bumped it up a little bit even more, just appreciation for, yeah, it's not perfect structurally, but like the conversations it's having and the things it's doing for the horror genre are like immense. And I think it does not get enough credit. Carol Kane is a fucking star. I love her so much. Everyone, if you haven't seen Office Killer and you want to see Carol Kane being nuts, see Office Killer. Really good slasher from, I think, the 80s. It might be on Shudder. Anyway, I love this movie. I'm really glad we got to talk about it more in depth than just about what it's doing on such a smart level. And yeah, so Dave, you have the final word. How many have you checked the children's out of 5 do you give this movie?
Well, you guys made so many great points about this movie that I didn't even think about. For me, as a kid who grew up looking up the stairs at the third floor, wondering what was up there all the time, every time I went to my house, walking with the hand beside the eyes to just avoid looking at it because I was just expecting a voice to come. I think the movie has its flaws, its age shows a bit, but it also has left an indelible mark. And that's if you look in like the kind of canon of all horror movies, not a lot of, you know, of everything, not a lot of movies get to do that. And I think what you said about Scream is amazing. Like, clearly, Wes Craven, right? That's Scream?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Wes Craven, he clearly was influenced by that too, because that is so, that opening is so the opening of that movie. I hadn't even thought about it until you said it. It's quite, you know. So I think in that regard, and even in its flaws, even as, I would say flaws, even if it's sort of slow paced cop drama, examination, there's something interesting about that. Like you said, there's something different about looking at the psychology of the killer. And there are these great moments, like the scene in the mirror. So for all those reasons, and because it scared the bejesus out of me as a little kid, I will chime in with a 4, have you check the children?
Hell yeah.
And, it's an iconic phrase too. Now, so much so that in the 80s they used to have that that PSA. It's 10 o'clock. You know where your children are.
Yes.
Oh, that's
absolutely.
Right.
And just briefly, I love when he changes the line later. He's like, "Why haven't you checked the children?" Like,
why haven't you
checked? Wants her to go check so bad. Yeah. It just it's so good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, for joining us to talk about When a Stranger Calls. Are you online? Where can our listeners find you if you are? And the floor is yours to plug away at whatever you have that you can talk about.
I wish I was more prepared for this. I'm actually in the process of doing a few new things, so I don't have anything to plug just yet. But just thank you guys for having me and letting me talk. As a writer, people don't let us talk a lot, so it's lovely to get
the chance
to talk about horror and just, you know, shoot the breeze about movies, man. You know, it's been awesome. You guys are fantastic. Thank you so much.
Do you have social media? Is there people can follow you, or do you not? Do you stay away from that?
I do. I have the Facebook. I have Instagram. I'm just terrible at it. I'm just that's my worst. I'm so busy writing and working that.
No, I feel that. I get that.
I can give you my social media, but I don't think that anyone cares about me.
Just plug it anyway, because who knows?
I don't. Here's how sad it is. I don't even know my Instagram handle.
Oh, hell yeah, love that. Well, and that's everyone also totally
I'm sorry. I'm Madelon Graham is my Instagram, but I don't post anything on there. I'm on Facebook, I guess. You can find me under Dave Madelon on Facebook, but
weird.
Dave, but
Facebook.
Yeah, I'm. I know. I. TikTok? I'm just not a big poster.
There's too much. It's just like too much content to create. But everybody watch Totally Killer on Prime Video, and then also watch The Clearing.
Who wants to see what kind of Belgian waffle I'm eating? You know? Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
You're good.
Yeah, please do watch Totally Killer. I will plug that. Totally Killer is amazing. You'll have a great time. It's a fun ride, and check out The Clearing on Crackle as well.
All right, listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with When a Stranger Calls, the original, or the 2006 one? You know, either one. You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us across social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and on Blue Sky. And I'm at mb.mcandrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And then, of course, follow the podcast if you haven't already. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Ooh, thank you, Derek Power, for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.